Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We have a rich program for you this evening, and I'd like to get the proceedings underway. The subject, as you are aware, is urban problem, and we have with us tonight, fortunately, two individuals, each in his own way, who can speak with great expertise, personal experience, and wide knowledge on this subject. I think before we begin with our speakers, I should outline to you very briefly the ground rules so you'll be just as aware as the rest of us under what codes and procedures we're operating this evening. Each speaker will speak approximately 15 minutes, will be flagged down approximately after he has finished that amount of time. Then there will be time for a 5-minute rebuttal of each speaker. And then the microphones, of which there are 6 scattered throughout the audience, 2 on the first level, 2 on the second level, 2 on the third level, will be open for audience participation. And if you do have questions, we hope you will begin to group yourselves when that time comes around the microphones. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce as our first speaker for this evening an individual who, as I've already indicated, has some of these urban problems at his before his daily attention. Mayor Sam Yorty of Los Angeles is the individual who presides over the third largest standard metropolitan area in the United States, an area that extends beyond 6 million individuals and is growing all the time. And Mayor Yorty has a wide experience in other congressional activities as well. He has been a member of Congress for 2 terms in 1950 or 54 and has had many other governmental posts. So I now turn the microphone over to Mayor Yorty.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Congressman Powell, hope you take your seat, Adam. members of the faculty and of the student body, first of all, I want to thank you for inviting me here to have an opportunity to discuss some of the urban problems with you. Urban problems seem rather simple to discuss tonight after discussing Vietnam and the Middle East at Yale University last night. That's a bit more controversial in some ways. I think we'd all agree that we have plenty of urban problems. And of course, the mayor is at the forefront of them because he's down on the firing line, and when things don't go right, the mayor gets blamed, and if they do go right, the great newspapers and the media take the credit. So you have this problem. And in Los Angeles, we have a peculiar problem in that the form of government is probably the most archaic of any city government in the United States and perhaps in the world. We have a city charter that divides authority and dilutes it to the point that it is described as a weak mayor, strong council form of government because the council is described as the governing body of the city. And I have a city council that meets every day, year round, and no mayor should have to put up with that. But however, it means then that you don't have clear lines of authority. And also, we have what is called a commission form of government. And by this, commissions, in many cases, are actually heads of departments. So you have 5 people who are lay people who come in once a week and get $10 a meeting, enough for the lunch and the parking, and are actually charged with making the decisions for great departments of government. Well, under them, and since I've been mayor, we have amended the charter to make some of them advisory, but not all of them. But under them, you have general managers who are under civil service. So when a mayor comes into office, he inherits, for better or for worse, a large corps of career people, and from a practical standpoint, there's no way to get rid of them, whether they function effectively or not. Theoretically, you could keep civil service ratings on them, and theoretically you could file charges, and if you could prove the charges, you could remove them. But in practice, it doesn't work out. So it's very difficult for any mayor in the city of Los Angeles to keep a tight hold on the executive reins and to see that his orders are carried out. You can give a lot of orders, but they're not always carried out. This problem is peculiar to us. I think some of the other cities, the mayor actually has more power. We're also different in another aspect of government, and that is that my office is nonpartisan. The mayor of New York and, of course, the mayor of Chicago, Philadelphia, Detroit are all elected on a partisan basis. But in the city of Los Angeles, you're not. You simply run. Anyone can run, of course, and everybody does. And if you get 50% of the vote plus one in the primary, you're elected. If you don't, you run off against the second man on the ticket, and then, of course, whoever gets the most votes is elected mayor. This is how I got to be mayor in 1961. I was second in the primary, but one out in the finals. Now, in San Francisco, they just run on a winner-take-all basis, which is a rather peculiar system. You can actually be elected mayor up there with maybe 30% of the vote, or maybe even 25, if enough people run, because the guy who gets the most votes wins. And under that system, Adam, I don't see how they'd ever beat an incumbent, because if you get yourself 20 opponents, which isn't too hard, you're bound to get more than they are. So it looks like to be a built-in system for incumbents, although it doesn't always work out that way. In the cities, great demands are made upon the city administrations to solve many of the problems. And of course, we have lots of problems. One of the foremost problems is how to finance all the ideas that people have for solution of the problems. No matter what you try to do, you end up at some point in the process of trying to get the money to perhaps just hire the expertise you need or to get the people to do the job and to do the planning and to do the execution. And some of these programs are very costly. Some of the existing programs are increasing in cost. For instance, in the matter of law enforcement, which is a very trying problem for all the mayors in the big cities, the cost is going up. It's costing more money to get the police officers. There's great competition by all of the big cities to just recruit the people that we want. So that competition, of course, is resulting in higher and higher salaries. And then, on the other hand, the members of the police department are insisting upon better standards, shorter week, shorter hours per week, overtime now, where we used to just give them time off when they worked beyond their 8 hours. Now, they're going to get time and a half in the future, and all of these things cost money. The firemen in most places demand parity with the police, although the jobs are entirely different. And so when you can't get police officers and your costs go up, the costs of maintaining the fire department go up. And of course, this constantly means that taxes go up. And people want the services, but they very naturally resent the taxes, particularly when they're applied to homeowners. The tax sources of the United States are thought to be roughly divided along the lines that the federal government taxes people on their income, and this could be personal or corporate. The states, by and large, we feel should be allowed to use the sales tax or the excise tax, and then the city, since the federal government's already plucked the man's income and the state has collected from him when he tries to buy something or use what money he has left, we're stuck with the main source as the property owner. We're not even allowed just to tax him exclusively, because you've got so many exceptions to these rules I've just told you that the whole thing is a maze of duplications. Federal government has income taxes, but so does the state. And now, in desperation, the cities are turning to income taxes, and where they don't have the legal power to tax on income, we're trying to evade it by taxing on something that is like income, and that is a payroll tax. And, of course, part of the justification for the payroll tax is that the core cities find that many people are moving out to the suburbs, and yet they work in the city and get their income there. And the only way you can compel them to share the cost of the services that they use when they're in the city is to tax them on some kind of a payroll tax or a type of income tax that gets them at the source through deduction or some other means of making them share that cost of government. So, of course, the mayors are constantly running to the federal government and demanding greater and greater federal outlays for the cities. We're constantly pleading with the states to give us more money. At the same time, when you're a member of Congress, you find that your own constituents are making demands upon you for federal programs that are always in excess of the money that's available at the federal level. And when you're a state legislator, as I've also been a state legislator, you have your own priorities, and your priorities mostly include the things that you'd like to do for your constituents in state programs. So by the time you get through with all them, you don't have enough money for all those state programs. And so down at the bottom of the pile is the poor mayor trying to figure out how to get along and how to do all these increased things and still at the same time not have an adequate tax base. So our chairman tonight is an economics professor, and I know this will remind him of many of the things that we have been trying to get across to the nation about the need to straighten out these tax structures, to try and have uniform taxation as much as we can, and to have tax sharing, to have the federal government, when they collect the income tax, to share it with the states or the cities on some set formula, so we don't go through mountains of red tape trying to get back a little of our own money to use at the city level. Now, because my friend Congressman Powell's here tonight, I might refer briefly, if I have time, to some of the problems we've had in the city of Los Angeles in the matter of integrating the city government. And I think Mr. Powell knows that when I was elected mayor in 1961, long before the current situation arose, I integrated the city government in Los Angeles. And I started out by asking minority people to serve on these commissions with me. And since the commissions are the heads of these great departments, this was an effective way to get minority people to come in and help govern. And I said in 1961 that I thought that we should tap this great reservoir of talent and that the minority people should come in and instead of being on the outside complaining or wondering about what was happening on the inside, that they should come on the inside and help govern the city. And so ever since 1961, in the city of Los Angeles, there have been three minority persons on the five-man police commission. So you can really say that the minority people are the head of the police department in the city of Los Angeles. Now, the same thing at the fire department. It's actually, Adam, it's hard for me to realize now that in 1961, the fire department in Los Angeles was segregated. It's just, you can't believe this is only 7 years ago. And yet in this city, which is liberal by almost any standard, we actually had a segregated fire department. And I went out to one of the fire stations, and the fellows were having coffee there, and I said, well, I know there's a Negro fireman assigned to this station. Where is he? And they said, he's in the boiler room. And I said, what's he doing in there? And they said, he's having his coffee. And I said, well, don't you all have coffee together? And they said, oh, no, we don't. And I said, well, you're going to. So I called in the fire chief, and I said, what is going on here? And he said, well, they don't eat together. So I said, well, they're going to have to eat together. And he said, well, Mayor, he said, you know, this is a hard problem. You've got to give me a little time. And I said, well, Chief Miller, time's up. And I had appointed three minority people on the fire commission. And I said, do you mean to tell me that these firemen are going to say that they won't eat with a member of the fire commission of the city of Los Angeles? And he said, oh, no, I wouldn't say that. And I said, well, okay, either everybody eats together or nobody eats at all. We abolish the mess. And the commission actually issued an order abolishing, and that's only 7 years ago in the city of Los Angeles. So we did integrate the government, and I think this is one of the reasons that I reacted with such disappointment when we were the city to have the first major riot, and that was in 1965. The year before that, the National Urban League had taken a rating using certain factors of all the big cities in the United States and reported that Los Angeles was the best large city in the United States for the minority people, specifically the Negroes, or black people, as some of the younger generation prefer to be called. But it's a difficult thing to know which term to use, because many of the older Negroes, I find that many of the older, the senior citizens, huh? Adam, just let me ask you, which do you prefer, or do you care?
Black, baby, black.
Black, beautiful. Okay, all right. Some of the senior citizens groups, I don't know, I often wonder, they seem to prefer the term Negro, but the younger people I know prefer black, and I prefer that myself. You should be proud of your color. That's right. We all should be. Well, at any rate, I've often said to my friends, you know, we all go out and lie on the beach forever trying to look darker, so it must be something good about the dark colors, But in 1964, we had this Urban League rating, and they did rate us the best big city. So then you have to ask yourself, why was Los Angeles the scene of the riot? And, of course, I don't have time now to go into all the factors over 100 years of frustration and anger on the part of the Negro people, the discrimination, unemployment in the area. But there was other areas so much worse that you have to ask, why was it Los Angeles? Well, those of you who have studied the theories of Marshall McLuhan are probably aware of the fact that while I don't agree with all of his theories, I think he has done some analysis that certainly deserves careful scrutiny. And I believe myself that the television is a tremendous factor in the national life of the country today. I agree with Marshall McLuhan. It is a cool medium. It does involve you. And I myself was very agitated in 1965 watching on television what was going on, where the Southern Christian Leadership Conference under Dr. Martin Luther King and other groups who were really peacefully demonstrating, simply kneeling down or sitting down in a park or some other place, protesting the fact that they couldn't even get the right to vote. And yet, when the police officers were ordered to do their duty, which you should never get in the habit of blaming the police, they take an order, they have to do what they're told. And if they're told to remove some people who are violating the law, well, they can't say, well, we won't enforce the law. So you don't help anything by hissing the name police officer. We have to solve these problems and think about them. And you got to remember that you have to remember that these young police officers, is the way they make a living. And they're told, you go do this. And they're told this man's violating the law, you do it. Well, if they want to keep the job, they have to carry out the law. So they were carrying people out of parks and whatnot, and the cameras were on. And I myself got agitated when people got out cow prods and started using dogs to chase peaceful demonstrators. I was agitated. So I knew how my black citizens felt, and I talked to them, and we knew they had the tension. And I think that one of the really big factors was the fact that for the first time in the history of the country, we were all taking part in the things that were going on in other parts of the country. And so it took nothing but an episode in Los Angeles to touch this off. It was a police incident, but it did not involve my police department. It involved the California State Highway Patrol. And when they came into this area where there was tension, they used procedures that we wouldn't have used, but that's water under the bridge. It happened, and the city of Los Angeles and Watts has been named as the area. But as a matter of fact, Watts is a 2.5 square mile area. It's a community of small homes and churches and schools. It isn't anything like the tenements in Harlem, for instance, that many Eastern writers think it is. When they come out there and see it, they're very much surprised. Well, any mayor could speak for 6 hours on urban problems. I've only touched on about three, and the chairman says my time is up. But thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mayor Yorty. Our next speaker has been elected to the House of Representatives continuously, although he hasn't served continuously. Since 1944, poring through the most recent election statistics on congressional districts, I find that Congressman Powell's most recent victory as of November 5th ran in the general range of 85% of the votes cast. So I think he speaks with the solid backing of his constituency, and it's my pleasure to introduce Congressman Adam Powell.
Thank you.
Whenever I see Mayor Yorty, we served together in the House 16 years ago, 18 years ago. I always call him Suffering Sam. Because anybody that has the problems of a large city today has to suffer. I don't think that whether it's Sam Yorty or John Lindsay or Daley, that any one man can solve the problems of these big cities. They're too vast. I don't think that any one man can solve the problems of this nation. They're too vast. And so I come to speak, and it's very harassing to limit a Black Baptist preacher to 15 minutes. But I come to speak about what I believe is a solution. I believe the solution to the problems of our cities, which means the solution to the problems of our land, lie in your hands. We've gone through all the studies by the Urban League. Urban League, Jesus, God have mercy. And Whitney Young. Yeah, he has studied us to death, and we're still dying from the studies. We've gone through all the monies that have been appropriated for urban renewal, which means Negro removal. And we've gone through all the monies for federal housing projects, and we're still right where we were, because the establishment has got this nation and your city and my city under control. And the definitive proof was what happened before the eyes of your parents when they looked at the TV camera in Chicago the other day, and they saw that the establishment didn't care whether you're black or whether you're white. If you were against the establishment, they were going to beat you. And they beat you in Chicago. White, you got beat. But as Mayor Daley said, we didn't kill anybody. I want to talk, therefore, about the role of young people. I would begin by talking about the black militants, because I want you out there to understand what this means. This means, as Suffering Sam said, do you want to be called black? Yes. You call yourselves white, so we want to be called black. It means that we're not anti-white, but we're pro-black. It means we do not believe in violence, but we do not believe in total nonviolence. As my Black Panthers in Harlem, who meet in my church, by the way, each week, say, we are not aggressors, but we are defenders. It means we have black dignity, black integrity, and we want black equality. And we want it now. 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 Now, when the B'nai B'rith and the American Jewish Congress and the Polish American Congress and the Italian Federation of Italian American Societies and the Loyal Sons of St. Patrick put a black man on their board of directors, then we might change our minds. But in the meantime, we're black. And black is not the color of your skin. Black is the way you think. In other words, there are a lot of you out there who can think black and still be white. That was taught to us a long time ago by a black Jamaican when I was 10 years old named Marcus Garvey. Black is the way you think. We're thinking black today. We're thinking the same as an Italian, an Irishman, a Pole, or a Jew who is proud of this nation, who wants to belong to it, but we want a piece of the action. And we've been waiting 300 years for it. And we're going to get it. We're going to get it, we hope, nonviolently. We're going to get it one way or the other. As Sherwood Eddy said in his closing paragraph in The Pilgrimage of Ideas, one way or the other, right or wrong, it's going to come. It's going to come. Second thing I'd like to talk about as regards our cities, as our incoming presidential... The scene is dismal. The scene is bleak. But I do think, because Dick Nixon served on my committee, by the way, and so did Jack Kennedy, God bless him, I know him. And I do have faith that Dick Nixon is going to emerge, much to the anger of his financial backers, a greater man than they think he's going to be. I have that faith in him. I have the faith in him because an office makes a man. I have faith in him because the times create a man. I have faith in him because there's a mandate, not only of the American people, but of the conscience of the world. He has got to be something that he has not been. And I believe that he can be. And in my own way, I'm willing to help him to be that kind of person if he will do certain things, and the certain things that I'm going to ask when I see him, and I hope to see him soon, is number one, get out of Vietnam now! Get out of Vietnam now! I see some of you back there not applauding, but I ask you that are not applauding one question. If we win the war in Vietnam, what have we won? If we win the war in Vietnam, then why not? Won't they bleed us again in Laos and Thailand and Cambodia? 35,000 have gone down the drain already, and I'm looking at the faces of some of you who will be lost in this war. Lost before you've had a chance to vote. Because America says you can die at the age of 18, but you can't vote till you're 21. $32 billion it costs us to wage that war. That's the money we need for our cities. That's the money we need for the war on poverty. That's the money we need for higher education. That's the money we need to make America the kind of America it should be. You can't do anything with Los Angeles any more than you have done, and you've done the best you can, as long as they have a war in Vietnam, because you haven't got the money. Watts erupted because Watts didn't have a bus line for the people of Watts to go down to the heart of Los Angeles to pick up their unemployment checks. Not a bus line. That was not your fault. It was the fault that we were squandering money abroad while American people were going down the drain. 1,500,000 white families in Appalachia making less than $1,000 per year per family from Georgia to Pennsylvania. 32 million people in this affluent society making under $3,000 a year per family, 80% white. Now I close with this challenge to you. I said there is no future in this establishment we have now. And I speak as one who has been in it. And that's why they put me out. That's why they put me out. They know I know all the facts. I was number 15 in seniority and number 8, number 7 in Democratic seniority, which meant as my people in Harlem sent me back and back. And this year, by the way, Sam, the percentage was the highest of any congressional district in the United States, 85%. No other congressman got that. And I didn't campaign, didn't spend a penny, didn't say a word. But they knew that as my people sent me back, there would just be a question of a matter of 4 or 6 more years. And those octogenarians tottering ahead of me would be gone. And the old man of the sea from Harlem would be number one. I said, great God Almighty, this man might be Speaker of the House. Third in line for presidency of the United States. Can you imagine that? He would paint the White House half black. He might even make Rap Brown Secretary of Defense. And Eartha Kitt would be Chief of Protocol, by the way. So I believe that now that 52% of this nation, 25 years of age or under, that if we can get together a coalition of blacks and white students and the poor, that come 72, led by young men like Gene McCarthy, Ted Kennedy, and Julian Bonn, we can have a coalition that'll make a new establishment for the people. All I'm pleading with you in these final moments is break away from the past. As Samuel Hoffenstein once wrote, he wrote the couplet for America's establishment today, come weal, come woe, my status is quo. Break away from that. You talk about the fact that when you became mayor, Suffering Sam, that the fire department segregated. It was just a few years ago on this campus that they had separate toilet facilities for black and white on this campus here. That's right. You talk about what's happening in Los Angeles? Look at Project 500 here on this campus. Look at Project 500 on this campus, where the university went out and solicited 500 people to come here and gave them certain promises and broke every one, and then sent 244 to prison, and they're out on bond now. Look at that. Search your conscience. Can you sit quietly by? Because what happens to me or what happens to them might happen to you, Mara. What happened to Jack Kennedy? What happened to Martin Luther King? What happened to Bobby Kennedy? We're living in a world in which everyone is a target. But a gaunt man once strode at midnight, and he said, there is only one government never perished from the earth. And he said, be a government of the people, black and white, and for the people, Jew and Gentile, and by the people, Protestant and Catholic.
Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman Powell. We will now have 5 minutes for Mayor Yorty, a return 5 minutes for Congressman Powell, and then we will put up the lights and permit you to participate. I might say at this point, we are pressed for time. Mayor Yorty has an appointment and has to catch a train, so we will probably have to conclude the formal part of our discussions this evening at approximately 20 past 9. Mayor Yorty.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, let me say, Adam, that I recognize that many urban renewal projects, of course, do include moving people, and oftentimes that means moving black people. And I think if you move them to a better area, and better housing, that then we should not use the fact that some people are being uprooted as an argument against all urban renewal, because I think you must recognize it's one of the tools that we have to have in real blighted areas where individual landowners are unwilling or unable to get together in any kind of a cooperative plan that is big enough to really do the big job, which really amounts to surgery. Now, we have had 3 years of squabbling over an urban renewal plan for what we'll refer to Watts as, for lack of a better name, although as I say, it's a misnomer, it's a very small area. We finally have agreed upon a plan, but you may be surprised to know that that one of the hang-ups was the fact that we included some industry in the area because we thought that it would be good to move industry right down into the area where we have the high unemployment, and the people then wouldn't have this transportation problem and some of the other problems. But we had some opposition based upon, really was just a suspicion that what we were trying to do is get more people out. And so we lost a lot of time and we've revised the project. We simply took the industrial part of the renewal project out. So now it will be commercial only and residential. But it is a tremendously controversial subject, and I don't like to see it get involved in anything emotional. I think each urban renewal project should be weighed on its own. And sure, if it's to move black people out and that's all it's meant to be, I would be against it. But on the other hand, I think some urban renewal projects you have to have. Now, I don't think it will do any good in this country to categorize all police as some kind of brutes and to hiss them every time they're mentioned. Because I'd like to call the attention of you young people who are going to take over complete charge of this government very soon, that you have to have some law enforcement agencies. And you've got to remember that if you go out on the street and somebody tries to beat you up or to rob you, you don't call the mayor. You call the policeman. And if he doesn't respond, you've lost a constitutional right to be secure in your person and your property. And if somebody breaks into your home at night, and injures you or your family, your loved ones, perhaps children, you don't call the mayor. You get on that phone to get the police department right away. And if that policeman doesn't come, then you've lost the right to be secure in your home. So without getting into any emotional argument with you, I only ask you to think a little bit about this problem and about the good side of law enforcement, the protection, the first line protection of your constitutional right to be secure in your person and your property. And it's very fallacious reasoning to take some incidents of police misconduct and reason from the specific to the general and say that because a few may be wrong and guilty of misconduct, that everybody is wrong. This has been happening to the black people too long. We've quoted statistics on crime and the number committed by black people, and too many white people then say all black people are bad. So don't make the mistake of turning this around and falling into that kind of fallacious reasoning. We've got to reason together in this country about these problems and unemotionally. And nothing made me happier than to hear Congressman Powell give Mr. Nixon at least a chance to show what he's going to do before people start turning against him and trying to obstruct him. Because the congressman, in my personal opinion, couldn't have been more right when he said the job makes the man. And I put it another way sometimes, and that is that in government, you just do what you have to do. I mean, you don't have a lot of alternatives. You have problems. And I don't care what campaign statements are made, or sometimes naive politicians make statements in good faith about things that they think they're going to do. They're going to cut the cost of government, for instance. And if they only knew more about government, they would know that they couldn't do it. But they, in good faith, make these false statements. Then when they get in, they don't cut the cost of government because they're faced with practical problems, not campaign speeches, and you do what you have to do. And Mr. Nixon is faced with all of these problems that we've had, including the Vietnam War. And no matter what has been said, he will, because now he has no place to go but history, and he will be doing his best to solve these problems, and it's best for the sake of the whole country if everybody will listen to Congressman Powell and join in to try and help him where they think he's right, and see if we can't draw this country together and start solving some of these problems unemotionally.
Congressman Powell?
I would like to take my time and indulge in a dialogue with my old friend, Sammy Ordy. But first, I would like to point out something for your skull, that the people that we are fighting for in South Vietnam under the immigration laws of the United States can't even become citizens of the United States. We're fighting to give them a democracy which we will not give them. Now, I'd like to indulge in a dialogue with my friend. Number one, do you not feel that policemen are underpaid?
The what?
Policemen are underpaid.
Well, I would say, on the whole, given the nature of the job today and the difficulties, that we should be paying them more.
Correct.
And
I agree.
Some of us are. But Los Angeles happens to be one of the cities where the rates are high relative to other places.
Now in Washington, D.C., the capital of the nation, it's very hard for the police department to recruit men with more than an eighth grade education because of the salary paid.
Of course, we wouldn't accept anybody.
All right, I'm pointing that out.
Under those circumstances, so we have very high standards. And as I think the congressman knows, New York, with 7 million people, has something like 26,000 uniformed
right.
police officers. Yeah. Los Angeles, with 3 million, has 5,500.
Yeah, see, there you are. Next,
Would
you not agree with me that it should be mandatory that no officer should be a member of the police department until he is first finished satisfactorily a course planned by outstanding sociologists and criminologists in human relations before it becomes an officer?
Well, to answer you, Congressman Powell, I am not sure that I would subscribe 100% to that. I think that an officer, of course, must be given all of this training. But you can train some people not 3 years, but for 20 years, and they're still not fit to do some of the jobs
correct,
they're trained
correct,
for.
Correct, correct.
So,
I agree.
And some people, without the going through the cloistered halls of these universities, have been pretty successful in life and have had great intelligence, because you don't have to go to a university to learn, really. You can learn by yourself.
You're missing the point there, Sam. What I'm trying to say is that a man becomes a policeman in your department and department in the city of New York and elsewhere on the basis of learning how to shoot, among other things. Why should there not be a course in human relations in the police academy so that he has to pass that course? And why should it not be, and it's taking place, by the way, as you know, as a member of the mayor's Council of the Nation, many cities are doing this. And it should be, I think, mandatory that they have a week each year to study human relations, because that, to me, is the most fundamental thing in a policeman's life, to learn how to get along with the people in his area.
Well, of course, we're one of the first to use, as you know, psychological tests before we will allow an officer to join the force. We also do teach human relations and social relations at our academy, and constant in-service training. Now, in the past few years, we have increased this tremendously. And I'm not one of those who goes around saying that that the rioting was all bad. I don't believe, of course, in looting and burning, but I know from my own experience that, for instance, I had a program in Los Angeles called the Community Analysis Program, and I wanted to apply to the federal government for the funds to finance it. And it really isn't anything more than an inventory of all your city resources, human and material, so that you can, in a definitive way, find out what your problem is, so you can try to apply a solution to it. And I couldn't get the city council of the city of Los Angeles to let me apply for the funds. They thought I was trying to put over some big urban renewal project, and the Los Angeles Times, my favorite newspaper, was against me on
That's a commercial, by the way.
Well, after the rioting, believe it or not, after the rioting, I got it through the council almost unanimously, and the Times supported me on it. So while I don't, as I say, I don't approve of rioting, don't advocate it, I know in my own case, the uprising helped me get some programs through that I didn't get through before the outbreak.
Well, our time has come to an end, but if the moderator will bear with me, one last question, which we have done very successfully in Harlem. As you know, we haven't had any trouble in Harlem. Do you not believe that there should be a conscious effort on the part of the mayors of the cities to go out, such as in your city, and recruit in every way possible members of the minority, such as Mexicans,
I certainly
Puerto Ricans,
and we are
black people,
yep,
to be members of the police force, yep, and when they are recruited, to serve side by side with their white brother in the, I don't call them ghettos, by the way, I call them the concentration camps. Don't you believe in that now?
Yes, I do, and as a matter of fact, we're doing it. And one way that people could help us to recruit black police officers would be not just to indiscriminately hiss all police officers, because this is one of the problems. We can't get black people to take the job in the police department, because they don't like the attacks made upon them and some of the unthinking criticism of all police. And so there's nothing we would rather have in the way of recruitment is to get more black police officers. We're going right down into the precincts. Now, we used to compel an applicant to come down to City Hall where we had the regular procedures. Now we go out into the area and invite people in, and we are doing better. We are getting more. But, of course, one of the problems we've had is some of the best ones have quit and got elected to the city council or studied law while they were policemen, became lawyers, and now judges, and just when they're really useful, they leave us. And you can't blame them for that. Everybody has a right to move ahead if he can, and it's a lot better these days to be a city councilman or a judge than a policeman.
I think it's time now that we'll open up the discussion to all of you. I'd like to say before we do this that as an educator of sorts, I am deeply moved by Congressman Powell's belief in the efficacy of a course in changing human nature. Myself, I haven't had that great success, and with more than 6 months at a time, or 3 months, or even just a series of lectures, but possibly differently structured materials might succeed in changing views which are based on much stronger types of factors. I wonder if the lights could be turned up here so that we could all be more aware of who's who. Is that possible? Can we get the lights turned up in for the audience?
Yeah, everybody can see us, but the congressman,
yes,
I can't see you.
In the meantime, let me again Let me call to your attention there. Microphones right down on the first row, microphones at the second tier, microphones at the third. So that's much better. Very good.
Where are our children?
Sir?
Yes, sir.
I have a question for both Mayor Yorty and Congressman Powell. Mayor Yorty, you said the policemen just followed their orders, but there isn't there something a little higher than the order of a Mayor Daley or a Mayor Yorty called a moral order, that you don't go out and hit everybody who's got a black skin, a beard, and long hair? Do you understand my question?
I can understand what I can hear, but it's I didn't hear what you said, that they go out and hit everybody with black skin. Was that what you said?
A beard and long hair.
Well,
I'm talking about the overreaction of the police department. Do they have to follow a law, an order, because it comes from a captain? You're talking about a moral order here.
There's such a reverberation here. I wish you could speak more slowly, because it's going around here, and I get you to hear you twice, practically.
What I'm saying is that you said that policemen just follow orders. And this has been brought out, I think, in the 1940s about following orders. And isn't there a higher order than that from a Mayor Daley, called a moral order, that you don't follow if this is against a moral, at least what should be a moral order?
Well, you have the privilege of following the order or quitting the job, if that's what you mean. And so a policeman, yes, if he doesn't like the job, he can quit. But if he wants to be a policeman, he has to enforce the law under the orders given to him. And of course, there's another side to this thing that hasn't been mentioned here tonight. Some of the baiting of some of our policemen and the provocations are withstood by many officers who are fine officers. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people in this room that might be critical of policemen who would not be able to stand up under the baiting and the provocations and keep their cool as much as some of our young officers with a high school education.
Congressman Powell.
Yes. My question is directed to Mayor Yorty. I'd like to ask you this. What do you think about black power as you conceive it? Do you see any usefulness in it, or you think it's just an outcast thing in our country?
Well, black power, as I understand it, has been useful even to me, as I just pointed out, in getting programs through for minority people where they organize and help you. You can help them. I've gone through the period in the city of Los Angeles, for instance, where we had a large Negro population, but most of them didn't vote. And as Congressman Powell knows, part of my constituency at one time, a large part, was black. And I had fine supporters in that community, and I was trying to get them registered. And I said to a man who is a black member of Congress today, but then he was an assemblyman, Augustus Hawkins, I said, Gus, why don't those people get out and vote? And he said, well, Sam, they still think there's a poll tax, and they're afraid that they'll have to pay. So they weren't using their black power, and they should use it. But, of course, power is subject to abuse. I don't believe in abusing power. But the right use of black power can be helpful to all right-thinking people.
Well, don't you think you're a conservative, super conservative?
The what?
Conservative.
That I'm too conservative?
Yes.
Well,
do you think that you
are
equipped?
I'd like to see anybody really define what you mean by conservative,
okay,
liberal,
that.
Progressive, radical today. It's
okay,
a
I'll
very a man
that.
Might be conservative on one thing like fiscal policy, and he might be very progressive on something else. Now, as far as human relations are concerned, I know I'm very progressive because I don't have these hang-ups and prejudices and hatred. I just don't believe in all that. I look at people
you?
On the basis of what they are. I don't care about color. Doesn't make any difference to me what color people are. I judge them by their character.
Yeah,
I think now another person. Yes.
Yes, Mayor Yorty, in reference to your previous statements on the mistrust of the police department in the ghetto and among the youth, wouldn't you think that this would be in part explained by previous studies such as the 1943 Michigan Civil Rights Commission study, the 51 American Bar Association study, the 61 and 63 U.S. Civil Rights Commission study, and the recent Kerner Commission study, all of which named the police as the major tool for the establishment in repressing people in the ghettos and other minority groups?
Well, there isn't any... there isn't any question about some of the facts of discrimination and abuse by establishments of authority exercised through the police department. Nobody's saying that isn't true. But I'm, as far as being here tonight, I'm only going to talk about my own city. I'm not going to get involved with the others, where the other mayors can speak for themselves. But we are trying very hard and making what I would consider a rather massive effort to improve relations between the police department and the so-called ghetto areas. And many of the programs that we have, we hope, are working. We think the situation is much better than it was before. We think there's more understanding. We think the training programs are working. At least we hope so. We're not just sitting around having emotional outbursts about the problem. We're working on the problem and trying to solve it. And it won't help it any, as I say, just to categorize all policemen as no good and call them pigs and provoke them while you're trying to solve a problem of improving relations with them. One of the problems you must realize, in the old days, a police officer walked the beat. When I was a kid in Lincoln, Nebraska, we had a fat cop, as we called him, named Nick, and we all loved old Nick. He'd chastise us when we were wrong, but we knew him, and he knew us, and he'd like to say to me, "You already cut it out and go home, or I'll go tell your parents or something." But nowadays, our police officers, because the criminals are mobile, and we're short of police officers, our officers are mobile. So they run around in an automobile, and there's somebody that you don't know. He's not a friend that you know. We are actually trying in Los Angeles. We're going to experiment with putting officers back on the beat so they can walk down in the communities and actually know the people. And I'm sure if they do that, that when they're attacked, that the people will come to their defense because they'll know them and understand them. But these are all practical things we're trying to do.
Yeah, well, young lady.
Congressman Powell, you expressed the hope
that... Oh, yes,
that
thank you. I'm going to sleep.
I didn't want you to fall asleep. You expressed the hope that if the war in Vietnam were ended, that the money currently being spent on that war would be poured back into this country and into some of the problems that need it. However, I've heard the speculation that if in fact the war is ended, that the money that is currently being spent on the war plus some will be poured back not into urban problems, not into some of the problems we need, but into more defense spending to increase the arms race. Is this true? And if it is, what the hell can be done about it?
Well, I would say that's one of the arguments used by the merchants of death, as Norman Cousins wrote in the Sad Review the other week. The Dow Jones average could not stand the shock of peace. But the American people could stand it. And knowing the programs that have come out of my committee, and I had 60% of the domestic programs of this nation. In fact, I think maybe this building came out of my committee, the Higher Education Facilities Act. I just got a report from Wilbur Cohen, Secretary of HEW, the other day. We're at $438 million spent on the campuses of America as a result of the Higher Education Facilities Act. Now, that money's got to be cut. We're going to continue to spend $32 billion per year in Vietnam. They're going to cut. Wilbur Mills cut $6 billion already. He told LBJ, "We're not going to raise the income tax 10% unless you let us cut $6 billion, not from the war, but from you and your parents and from the American mainstream." And I don't believe that we should be the cops of the world. I don't believe God ever ordained any one nation, Deutschland über alles, or America über alles, to be the cops of the world. I do believe in a strong defense. And that's why we call the office the great misnomer of history. the Secretary of Defense. I believe it should be a strong defense, ready to defend our land. But I believe and I know, as one who's been inside for 24 years, that money can be plowed back into America if we accept our role as defenders of this land and not cops of the world.
This is for Mayor Yorty. The people don't hiss because the police react. The people hiss because the police overreact. And I would like to ask you, as mayor of the city, what you could do about that.
Well, I'm sure that sometimes we, of course, have problems with overreaction. And we also have some overreaction by dissident elements that deliberately bait and provoke policemen. And one of the things, of course, that people don't hear always is a provocation, because sometimes some of the chants are so obscene that the radio and television people have to turn off their microphones, and the public gets a one-sided idea of these things. But we're not saying we don't have a problem. What we're saying is that you don't solve it by constantly berating all police officers and equating the overreaction of a few with all policemen. And I'm trying to tell you that that's the same thing a lot of whites been doing to black people for a long time, and it's just as unfair in that regard.
What I'm asking is what you as mayor could do about it.
Stopping overreaction?
Yes.
We have a very tight discipline in our community, and again, I say I'm not talking for the others. Where there's any police misconduct, they have to go before a board, which they call the headhunters, and they get disciplined. And I think that we have a highly disciplined police force in Los Angeles.
Congressman Powell, what do you think of Mayor Lindsay and the situation in New York?
Well, knowing John as I've known him for years in the House, knowing the city of New York, I think the whole problem there is hopeless. Little boy Blue, come blow your horn. The sheep are in Central Park and you're full of corn.
Yes, I
don't think I don't think anyone can run New York, including Sam Yorty.
See.
Too big. Should be split into five cities. Harlem being one of course.
I wanted to ask Representative Powell a question about urban renewal in Harlem. During my Peace Corps training, I lived in Harlem and saw many of the urban renewal projects. And both in Harlem and East Harlem, many of the urban renewal buildings are rather characterless, and they've lost all sense of a human environment. They're sterile, big, and they're not necessarily any cleaner, because the same dope peddling is going on in the elevators and hallway shafts as elsewhere in other parts of the city. And you talked about urban renewal as in some cases being Negro removal. But now, if we don't have urban renewal projects, will the new 1968 Housing Act and perhaps the private ownership that Senator Percy has advocated, will this help solve this problem of the absentee landlordism, which according to many of the people I met who were connected with MEND, Massive Economic Neighborhood Development, said that the people living in Harlem would bring these cases against their landlords. They would accredit so many points against them, it would have to go to court. But the landlord would, of course, sell the building in a blind name so that the counts are all dropped, the case keeps perpetuating, and nothing gets done. So what do you feel the answer would be for Harlem? Is it preservation of the present buildings, or private ownership, or what do you feel?
Well, since you worked in Harlem, you know, and I regret to say this in front of my friend from the West Coast, we have built and are building, we just finished the Esplanade Gardens, 10 26-story houses built on land where the subway used to be. 10 26-story houses, 260 floors. We have I was going to get around to this if I had a chance. We have a system in Harlem where you cannot move tenants out unless you provide a place for them to go, and then they get first opportunity at the new building when it's built. Do you have that in Los Angeles?
Yes, that's more or less of a one of the new rules of urban renewal.
We have it more or less. We have it more.
Well, hey, you got it.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
I didn't hear what you said, Adam.
But
let me say this, Mr. Chairman. Urban renewal is a relatively new tool for trying to do something about rejuvenating the cities. And
I think we have time here for three very brief questions if you make your question precise and to the point. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I think you are missing the aisle up here. You've yet to call on anyone. It's up here on the third.
Sorry,
up here,
I'm
right,
sorry,
right here, Mr. Chairman. Chairman, right here.
I don't know where you are, but.
That was the shortest question.
Yeah, Yardy has to get a train.
Mr. Yardy, I don't know how many people here have been to California or have lived there, but I spent 10 years there. So when you talk about the Los Angeles Police Department, see, you can tell them a whole lot of things, but you can't tell me that. See, when I was 15 years old, I got my first beating from a white Los Angeles policeman who I should not hiss. He whipped me real good, and I'll never forget it. That's just on your policeman now. That's all I wanted to say on that. Now, when you talk about urban renewal, and when you talk about take a look, well, you take a look in Watts, and you look in them two and a half square miles that you're talking about, and you look at the projects there. You look how black people are living on top of one another there. And then, see, don't say it don't look too bad. Don't say it's too unsafe, because I know about the bookie joints. I know about the dope that's being shot there. And I know about all the crime and things that's going on there. Now, when you talk about urban renewal, moving people out, all urban renewal is doing is tearing down the buildings that black people live in, and then they're not building up any other buildings. And then once the black people do move out, they usually stay in the same community, and the community is twice as dangerous, twice as unsanitary. The living conditions are worse simply because they stay in that community and they have to stack up more just like they were before, but only twice as worse since you've torn down those buildings. That's all.
Sir, will you come to your question now, please?
As a mayor of Los Angeles, I'm wondering, what are you willing to do about those projects there? When you know urban renewal is what urban renewal is doing, maybe you didn't know then, but now that you do know, what are you going to do about it now?
Yeah.
And what are you also going to do about the policemen that whipped me and that are whipping my black brothers and sisters down there now?
Well, what you're saying is that one police officer who beats you up when he shouldn't makes all police officers bad. And this is a dangerous way to reason. Now, you can reason that way if you want to, but I don't think you ought to go all of your life harboring hatred against all police officers, black and white, I would assume, because you were wronged by one, assuming that what you say is correct. As far as urban renewal goes, your argument would just end all urban renewal. And I don't think that that's the way you solve problems. If there's an injustice in it, you correct the injustice. And in Watts, we have taken out, as I say, even the industry to try and please the people, but the people in the area have been consulted. This is something else we've learned about urban renewal. We have to do a better job of community relations. And we appoint now committees of the people from the area themselves, and they're brought into consultation at all stages, and unless they approve it, we just drop it. We dropped one in Los Angeles the other day called the Temple Urban Renewal Project because the people in the area protested too much against it, so we said we won't go ahead. But this is a matter of evolving ways to make programs work and to see that they're just. Now, I'm very sorry myself that I have to catch this train. I have a speaking date in Los Angeles tomorrow at noon that I can't get out of, And it's very hard to get transportation from this area into Chicago at this hour of the night.
Just like what?
There are no more planes. I can catch a train at 9:55, which will get me in Chicago at midnight if it's on time. I can catch a plane at 1 o'clock out of O'Hare and be in Los Angeles at what'll be 5 o'clock to you, but 3 o'clock in Los Angeles. So you can see I have a real problem at timing, and I'm just going to have to leave. But I've enjoyed being here, and I enjoyed visiting with you.
Congressman Powell has very generously agreed to stay and answer questions for 5 minutes. And,
so it shouldn't be a total loss.
Yes, sir.
How would you have handled the Chicago convention demonstrations had you been making the decisions rather than
Mayor
Daley?
I would first have said to the followers, most of them were followers of my beloved friend Gene McCarthy, some of them were not, but I would have the leaders of his youth section apply for permit to parade. And I would have given them the right to parade, and under that permit, they could parade to the auditorium or whatever other rendezvous that was mutually agreeable to the establishment of Chicago and the youth group that was backing McCarthy. I would have given them the right to have free speech in the park. I would not have put a curfew on them. And I think that under those conditions, maybe incidents would have broken out because, as you know, there were some there who were there just to cause incidents, but the vast majority were there as young Americans to express their views and their voices concerning the man that they were in back of, Gene McCarthy. That's the way I've done it. But under no circumstance can anyone any day anymore tell black and or white young people, no, that day's gone. Gone, gone with the wind. There's a seething among young people today, and I've spoken, this is my last speech since January, that concludes my tour. I've spoken to over 125,000 from San Diego State right on up to here, all across the country. I felt the pulse, and there is a seething in the hearts of young people. As Matthew Arnold wrote 35 years ago, we stand between two worlds. One world is dead, and the other world has not yet been born. And I think we're now going through the process of labor, of bringing about the birth of a new America, because the old America is finished. Finished. America of your parents, your priests, your preachers, and your politicians, gone. Gone.
Congressman Paul, Eldridge Cleaver, in his recent interview in Playboy magazine, said that he opposes you because you represent the black middle class and not the black masses. Could you comment on this?
Yeah, all I've got to say is look at my vote in Harlem, that's all. 85%, the largest in this nation for me. Come to my church, if you will, this coming Sunday and try to get in. I'll speak to 6,000 this coming Sunday.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to direct my question to Mr. Powell. Should I direct
somebody,
to
somebody ask Powell? Him a question.
Well,
go ahead.
I too was once a resident of, you might call, a concentration camp.
Uh-huh.
All right, every black person in particular dreams of occupying a lofty position away from the petty and humdomness of ordinary living. All right, as a member of the Project 500, I learned one thing, and that is to straighten your back up. Because whenever, you know, men straighten their backs up, they're going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. What happens to the educated black man? What does he do?
Well, in the first place, I sounded this before when I gave the baccalaureate at Howard University about 5 years ago. I would say that unless the black man or the soul sister and their family have enough money to send them on through to a profession, that getting a bachelor's degree today is the same as a high school diploma 25 years ago. That goes for whites as well as blacks. I would say to the young people of America, black and white, if you haven't got money to go on into a profession, law, medicine, teaching, or into one of the new sciences of electronics, the best thing to do when you get out of high school is go and take a course with IBM or some other UNIVAC or someone else and get your computer knowledge and get a job right away in electronics. We're living in a different type of a world today, a world in which you have to be skilled, and unless you have the money to go on and pursue those skills, you're wasting your money and your time right here and everywhere else on the campuses of America. That's the future for black and for white.
We'll have time for one more question. Yes, sir.
Congressman Powell, you gave some very possible explanations for your release from Congress, but what specifically were the terms behind your release?
Was that one? What was that one? I couldn't get that one, I'm sorry. You're reading it.
Yes, I am.
Go ahead. Once over again, lightly.
You gave some very possible explanations for your release from Congress, but what specifically were the terms behind your release?
Oh, there were no terms at all. It was just...
Well, then why were you released?
Huh?
Well, then why were you released if there were no terms?
Well, now let us take their old Christian Tom Dodd over here. And let's take Soul Brother Powell from Harlem over there, see? Now, Tom Dodd, you see, was fooling around with his secretary. And, Boyd was an administrative assistant. And good old Christian Tom Dodd came back one night after he left the office. And he found his girl with Brother Boyd, sort of snuggling a little bit, you know. And he fired him. But he made the mistake. You see, whenever I fire anybody, I demand their keys immediately and also change their locks. He fired him and let him work for 2 weeks, and they stole from his files his actual documents and gave them to Drew Pearson, who then turned them over to the Senate. Now, the Senate has possession of the actual documents. Oh, incidentally, Boyd married the girl later. That's such a better thing. The Senate had the documents proving the fact that the monies that were given for dinners and so forth and so forth and so forth, supposedly for campaign, that dear old Christian Tom Dodd had put in his pocket. Now you come over here and you see the old man of the sea from Harlem, you see, and all they had were allegations. We accused. But not one document. So he, they slapped on his wrist, and he said, thank you. And then they said to me, now, if you just shuffle down the aisle and say, yes, boss, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. But I ain't gonna do that. I had a grandfather as a slave. My father was born on a plantation. I'll be damned if I'm going back to that.
Congressman Powell. Congressman Powell.
Thank you for your attendance, and you've been a fine audience. Good night.